Omaha Public Radio presents another lecture program from Creighton University on Noon Forum. We'll hear a talk by Wei San Dun, Special Agent in Charge of the Omaha Division of the Federal Bureau of Investigation. Mr. Dun's appearance was presented by the Creighton University Asian World Center as part of their Distinguished Lecture Series in collaboration with the Creighton Students Union. He'll speak on the topic, Navigating the Cyber Threat Landscape of the 21st Century. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Thursday afternoon, March 29, 2012, for broadcast at this time. The opinions expressed are those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of Creighton University, KIOS-FM, or the Omaha Public School District. Here now to introduce the speaker is Mark Turner, Assistant Dean of the Creighton University College of Arts and Sciences.
In January 2010, the FBI Director Robert S. Mueller named Wei San Dun Special Agent in Charge of the FBI's Omaha Division. Mr. Dunn's previous assignment was as Special Agent in Charge of the Newark Division, and at lunch he was telling me that the Newark Division population was about 9 million he had to take care of. It's not quite that. His territory here is the Nebraska-Iowa territory, much less people, but much farther distance. And he said that he has the most field offices, resident field offices, in the agency. Mr. Dun began his career as an FBI agent in 1982. He served in San Francisco, Omaha, and Chicago divisions, where he specialized in national security, high technology theft, extremist and violent crime investigations. While in Omaha, Mr. Dun directed and conducted a domestic terrorism investigation that resulted in the dismantling of an extremist organization in southeastern Nebraska in 1985. In 1988, Mr. Dun was promoted to Supervisory Special Agent of the National Security Division at FBI headquarters in Washington, D.C. He also served as an assistant inspector in the Inspections Division. In 1991, he became a supervisory senior resident agent in the Hartford, Connecticut resident agency. While there, he directed several violent crimes gang task forces that helped dismantle a number of violent street gangs in Connecticut. Mr. Dun also led numerous organized crime drug enforcement task force investigations targeting major drug trafficking groups in New England. Mr. Dun returned to the FBI headquarters in 1997, where he directed the creation of the first program management and coordination unit in the Organized Crime and Drug Investigations branch of the Criminal Investigation Division. He served as its chief until he was designated Assistant Special Agent in Charge of the Omaha Division in 1998. In Omaha, Mr. Dun directed a number of significant drug, violent crime, domestic terrorism, and cybercrime investigations and the implementation of the Nebraska-Iowa Joint Terrorism Task Force. In July 2002, he was promoted to inspector in the Inspections Division. He served in that role to 2003, where he's designated as a special agent in charge of the Springfield Division. Nearly 4 years later, in April 2007, he was serving in the New York Division. Mr. Dun is a native of Kirksville, Missouri. He earned a Bachelor of Arts degree from Cornell University in Ithaca, New York. His service in the nation has also included time in the United States Army, where he served as a military intelligence officer, reaching the rank of captain. His many awards include the Illinois State Police Director's Award of Distinction and the Illinois Law Enforcement Training and Standard Board Distinguished Service Award, an honorary doctorate from Yeshua University, the Presidential Meritorious Executive Rank Award, which recognizes a select group of career federal senior executive service employees each year. This award is conferred by the President of the United States in a recognition for sustained accomplishment. And he's also been awarded the Army Meritorious Medal. This afternoon, Mr. Dun will discuss some challenges and mitigations to our current cyber threat. In my opinion, we couldn't be talking about a more relevant subject. Just in the past 5 years, we've seen a continued and ever-sophisticated cyber attack against government, financial institutions, and other giants in the corporate world. Even with increased vigilance, these attacks are becoming costlier and more destructive. So without further delay, let me please introduce to you Mr. Wei San Dun.
Thank you very much for that very gracious introduction. I think that just firmly establishes that I am the official fossil of the FBI, having served for 30 years. It truly is my pleasure to be here and an honor to be invited. You know, the title Special Agent in Charge, a lot of people think that's a very fancy title. Really, I tell people what that really means. I'm the guy they blame when something really bad happens. So happy to answer any questions at the end about either my remarks or about the FBI in general. And I agree with the introductory remarks in terms of the timeliness of this topic. I always like to start my presentations on any topic with a lighthearted story that hopefully has some relationship with the topic at hand. And today is no different. So let me start by telling you a quick story that took place in Seattle, Washington. Now, this story is about a touring helicopter, the kind that tourists can pay money for and do some sightseeing. So one day in Seattle, Washington, this touring helicopter company gets hired, and the pilot takes some tourists up for an aerial tour of Seattle. Well, any of you who have been in the great Northwest know that one of the hallmarks of Seattle is that it is quite rainy and foggy at times. And as luck would have it, on that day of this helicopter tour, a heavy, dense fog rolls in, the cloud cover drops, and suddenly there's absolutely no visibility. And then, as luck would have it, the avionics on this helicopter completely fail. So the pilot is up there flying around, completely blind, not able to see anything. The tourists begin to panic, and everybody is starting to get concerned. Well, the pilot, keeping his wits about him, slowly maneuvers until he sees a building looming in the distance. And he inches closer and closer to this building and starts circling the building very, very carefully. Soon, as he hoped, people inside see this helicopter circling, and they start running to the windows and looking and trying to figure out what's going on. At that point in time, the pilot pulls out a big piece of cardboard that he keeps in the back of the helicopter precisely for such types of incidents. And he gets a magic marker, and he scrawls in big block letters on this piece of cardboard, "Where am I?" And he starts circling closer and closer to the building. He holds it up to the window, hoping that somebody inside the building will see his sign. And lo and behold, people see the sign. He sees scurrying around. People were running around inside an office, and they, too, make a big sign on a piece of cardboard. They come back and hold it up to the window. And the sign says, "You are in a helicopter." Well, you know, people really start panicking now. But the pilot, you know, he just nods. He pulls out his books, does some quick calculations, and he flies right back to his home base safely, completely blind. Of course, the tourists are amazed, and they said, "How did you do that?" That answer didn't seem at all to make any sense to us. And the pilot said, "Well, it was easy." He said, "Because that answer was technically accurate, but essentially useless at a practical level. I knew that had to be the Worldwide Help Center for Microsoft." So, so easy. Now, my apologies to anybody that owns Microsoft stock or perhaps works for Microsoft. Now, you know, most of you got that joke, probably because most of you have used Microsoft products at some point or know somebody that has. I ask you to think about the implications of that for a moment. You know, computer technology and the internet have now truly become one of the shared experiences that help form the fabric of our society. And these days, the latest YouTube video that has gone viral is likely to be the topic of casual conversation as much as the latest news headlines. And indeed, in some circles, perhaps even on this campus, you're more likely to hear conversation about the latest YouTube video than what the latest news headlines say. Computer technology is now available to the masses, and the growth of the internet has thrown open the windows of the world. We now learn, communicate, conduct business, and socialize in ways that were unimaginable 20 years ago, perhaps even 10 years ago. This is truly the positive side of the advances in automation and information technology that the world is now benefiting from, much of which was pioneered right here in the United States. However, there is a downside, and that's the downside that I intend to focus my remarks on today. The downside of our increasingly digital and virtual world is that the internet is not just a conduit for innovation, commerce, and social interaction, but it has also become a conduit for crime, terrorism, and espionage. The internet has created virtual doors into our lives, our finances, our businesses, and our national security. And the challenge we face is that criminals, spies, and terrorists are testing our virtual doorknobs every day, looking for a way in, looking for a way to hurt us. Some of the most critical threats facing our nation today emanate from the cyber realm. President Obama has called the cyber threat one of the most serious economic and national security challenges we face as a nation. And FBI Director Robert Mueller, my boss, testified before the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence this past January, and he stated in his Senate testimony that in the future, he believes the cyber threat will be the number one threat to the security of the United States, surpassing even the terrorism threat and the foreign espionage threat. In another speech at the annual RSA conference in San Francisco just last month, Director Mueller reiterated his belief that the threat from cyber attacks will become the greatest threat to our nation. I will submit to you that the cyber threat is an existential threat, meaning that a major cyber attack could threaten the very existence of our country, the very existence of our society. A major cyber attack could potentially wipe out whole companies. It could shut down our electric grid or water supply. It could cause serious damage to parts of our cities and ultimately could even kill people. The cyber threat has the potential of being a true game changer. It could challenge our nation's very existence or alter our nation's potential. And while some may feel that that is an alarmist statement, I'm here to tell you the threat is incredibly real, and intrusions into our corporate networks, our personal computers, and our government systems are occurring every single day by the thousands. So what does the current cyber threat landscape, the cyber threat landscape of the 21st century, look like? Well, I plan to share with you in the next half hour or so the FBI's perspective on the cyber threat landscape of the 21st century, and also I plan to share with you some thoughts on what we as a society may wish to do to mitigate the threat. It's important to remember that I represent the FBI, and the FBI is a counterterrorism, counterintelligence, and law enforcement agency. So the cyber threat view that I will be sharing with you today is through the lens of a civilian intelligence and law enforcement agency. There is another view of the cyber threat about which I will not speak today, and that's the whole concept of cyber war, the use of the computer as an instrument of mass destruction from a military perspective. A discussion of cyber war is more appropriately handled by a military officer than by an intelligence executive or law enforcement executive like me. So I will not be talking about that, but for those of you interested in this aspect of the cyber threat, I would recommend that you read a recent book entitled Cyber War. I have a copy here. It's written by Richard A. Clark and Robert Naik. For those unfamiliar with the name, Richard Clark is a former White House official who has served both Republican and Democratic administrations, and he is now a professor at Harvard, and he has written extensively about the terrorism, the foreign intelligence, and now the cyber threats facing our country. From the FBI's perspective, we see three primary types of threat actors in the cyber world. First, we see foreign intelligence services. The second category would be terrorist groups. And the third category is organized criminal enterprises. On the foreign intelligence front, there are dozens of countries that now have offensive cyber capabilities, and their foreign intelligence services are generally the most capable of our cyber adversaries. You know, espionage has been around for centuries, and we've been dealing with that for centuries. However, espionage is no longer focused on the traditional spy, the human being who infiltrates an organization under false pretenses. In the intelligence community, the traditional spy is referred to as human intelligence or HUMINT. You'll hear that term tossed about. Well, while HUMINT is still a concern and still a profession practiced by many individuals and used by many nations, foreign intelligence services now also use remote exfiltration of terabytes of sensitive data and intellectual property. They engage in systematic intrusions into businesses and government entities. The United States Office of the National Counterintelligence Executive, or NCIX, as it's known to those of us in the government, submits an annual report to Congress regarding its assessment of the greatest threats facing our country. Their most recent report was submitted in October 2011, and it dealt with foreign economic collection and industrial espionage, and I have a copy of that here as well. This is an unclassified document. It is available on the Internet, and I would encourage you to take a look at it because, among other things, this document says that that foreign economic collection and industrial espionage against the United States represents significant and growing threats to the nation's prosperity and security. This document further says, increasingly, economic collection and industrial espionage occur in cyberspace, reflecting dramatic technological, economic, and social changes that have taken place in recent years in the ways that economic, scientific, and other information is created, used, and stored. Now, the targets of your foreign intelligence cyber threat run the gamut from government networks to cleared defense contractors to private companies from which they seek to steal secrets or gain competitive advantage for their nation's companies. One company that was recently a victim of a foreign intelligence intrusion determined that it had lost 10 years worth of research and development valued at $1 billion virtually overnight. So what countries are doing this? What countries pose the greatest cyber espionage threats? The answer shouldn't surprise you. The unclassified NCIX report that I referred to earlier, and you can read for yourself if you wish, says Chinese actors are the world's most active and persistent perpetrators of economic espionage, and Russia's intelligence services are conducting a range of activities to collect economic information and technology from U.S. targets. Indeed, China's efforts to steal sensitive American technologies and proprietary information is so pervasive and so prolific that some experts in the field have described the situation as tantamount to being the United States actually financing all of the PRC's research and development efforts. With regard to terrorism, we know that terrorist groups are very interested in impacting this country through a digital attack in the same way that they have historically attacked us through kinetic means. They're always looking for creative ways, to hurt us. Some say that terrorist groups currently do not have the capability to do it themselves, and while that may be true, the reality is the capability to conduct such an attack is available on the open market. If you know where to look for it on the Internet, you yourself can find it. And as 9/11 taught us, we cannot assume that just because something has not been done before, that it is not a possible threat. So while terrorists have not yet used the Internet to launch an attack, their intent to do so should not be underestimated. We know terrorist groups are already using the Internet in a variety of ways. For example, Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, one of Al-Qaeda's known franchise affiliates in the world, publishes an English-language online magazine called Inspire. And Inspire is used by Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula to share ideas, recruit members, and even provide training on terrorist tactics and tradecraft. In Somalia, Al-Qaeda's affiliated group there, Al-Shabaab, uses the Internet to taunt enemies, to encourage terrorist activities, and to recruit. And in fact, Al-Shabaab particularly targets its Internet recruiting campaign on American youths. They have done such things as produce rap videos targeting American kids attempting to recruit them to join their cause. We also know that the individuals who claimed responsibility for the attempted bombing of Times Square in May 2010 we know that they conducted reconnaissance and surveillance of potential target sites through public web cameras available on the Internet. We know they also shared operational details on file-sharing sites and communicated by remote conferencing software. So the fact that they use the Internet in these ways, I suggest, indicates that the potential of a cyber terrorist attack is not that far-fetched. A more detailed discussion of the cyber threat from either foreign intelligence services or international terrorist groups would require me to delve into classified material, and of course this is not a classified presentation, so I have to defer any additional comments about these two topics for another forum. I wish now to turn, however, to the threat from organized criminal enterprises, because that is also a very, very significant threat to our economy and indeed to our society. Organized crime groups are increasingly migrating their traditional criminal activity from the physical world to the cyber world. Now, rather than breaking into a bank to crack the safe or to rob it at gunpoint, criminals are breaching corporate networks and financial institutions to pilfer a plethora of data, including such things as user credentials, personally identifiable information, and corporate trade secrets, all of which they can then monetize. These groups are often made up of individuals living in desperate places around the world, and they have stolen hundreds of millions of dollars from the financial services sector and from its customers. Their crimes increase the cost of doing business. Their crimes put companies at a competitive disadvantage. It creates a significant drain on our economy, and ultimately, it takes money out of your wallets and out of your purses. In one of the most sophisticated and organized attacks on the financial sector, an international network of hackers obtained access to a financial corporation's network and completely compromised its encryption system. They then stayed inside this particular financial corporation's network for months, watching, doing reconnaissance, recording who does what, capturing sensitive information, and then after doing so, they were able to steal millions of dollars in less than 24 hours when they finally decided to take covert action. Now, I will not mention the name of that company, nor any other companies to which I refer, because one of the things that we in the FBI assure our customers, if you will, the public, is that when we conduct an investigation into a cyber intrusion, we respect confidentiality, we respect proprietary information, and we also respect the reputations of the companies or individuals involved. So we don't disclose who the victims were unless, of course, it comes out in court. And at that point in time, it's a success story because it means we're bringing somebody to justice for committing a very serious crime. Another major international hacking group distributed malicious software, which allowed them to use the automated clearinghouse wire transfer system to access online commercial banking accounts. This particular group stole nearly $70 million. Now, for those unfamiliar with what an automated clearinghouse transfer is, or an ACH transfer as we refer to it, that is the mechanism that is behind the scenes every time you use your credit card, every time a company pays a bill online, every time you authorize an electronic funds transfer from your checking account to somebody you're doing business with. It is also used for business-to-business transfers. So the ACH system, the automated clearinghouse system, is in many ways the backbone of electronic commerce. The investigation into this particular case that I'm talking about was codenamed Operation Trident Breach. The significant thing about this particular investigation, in addition to the fact that the criminals stole nearly $70 million, is that this case was initiated and directed by agents of the Omaha field office of the FBI. FBI agents right here in Omaha, under my command, were the ones that initiated this case and successfully brought it to fruition. The agents here in Omaha became aware of the crime as a result of our ongoing liaison and partnership with the financial services industry. We were given a tip that there were a series of suspicious financial transactions that just didn't look quite right to the person who brought them to our attention. We initiated an investigation and were able to determine that most of these financial transactions were being initiated from Ukraine and from Russia. And as a result of a multi-year investigation, we determined that criminals in the Ukraine and Russia were using what is known as spear phishing tactics to insert a variant of the Trojan Zeus virus into the computers of individuals that had some connection to the finance and accounting elements of small to medium-sized businesses, of government entities, and of nonprofit agencies. They particularly targeted small to medium-sized businesses, nonprofits, and small to medium municipal government agencies because they rightfully suspected that these types of organizations would not have the robust cyber defenses that a multinational corporation or a large municipal government might have. Once the criminals succeeded in inserting the malware onto the computers, again, of individuals that had some nexus to the financial aspects of their organizations, the criminals were then able to use this malware to siphon money out of the bank accounts of these entities by initiating ACH transfers, automated clearinghouse transfers, as if they were the customer themselves. Much of their criminal activity, we determined, was conducted through computer servers located in the Netherlands. And this case was precedent-setting on a number of fronts, in addition to the fact that it was initiated and directed out of Omaha, Nebraska. It turns out that this was the largest ACH fraud investigation that the FBI has ever encountered. It was one of the largest involving an organized criminal enterprise, and it involved heretofore unseen and unprecedented international cooperation. In October of 2010, when we were ready to file charges and make arrests, FBI agents from Omaha, Nebraska were actually dispatched to London, Russia, the Netherlands, and Ukraine to coordinate and execute searches and arrests. And it was all directed from my command center not too far from here. That was quite a unique operation, not only because of the different time zones involved, but really the different cultures involved. Trying to coordinate raids between the Metropolitan Police in London and New Scotland Yard and the paramilitary police in Ukraine, it was quite a challenge, and I'd be happy to share some of those stories at some point. I was getting calls from my agents literally from around the world saying, you're not going to believe what's happening here, but we ultimately were able to cause everything to come together. The two cases that I've highlighted, in particular the one that emanated and was directed from here in Omaha, illustrate the global nature of cybercrime and show that the offense clearly outpaces the defense in today's cyber realm. It's very difficult to put a price tag on all of this criminal activity, but a number of private consulting firms have attempted to do that. In 2011, the Norton Corporation, most of you are probably familiar with that, published a cybercrime report that put the global cost of cybercrime at nearly $400 billion a year. The 2011 Norton Cybercrime Report also found that there are more than 1 million victims of cybercrime every day. And a study released last August by the Poneman Institute found that the number of attacks on companies it surveyed in 2011 were up 45% from 2010 and cost 70% more to fix. On average, according to their survey, each attack took approximately 18 days and $416,000 to recover from. And that's only the tip of the iceberg, because all the cases to which I've referred and the statistics that I just quoted to you refer to what we call remote access attacks. That's where somebody sitting in a remote location, probably even in another country, is able to intrude upon your computer or your computer network. Well, in addition to remote access attacks, the reality is our adversaries are using multiple attack vectors, including things such as attacking the supply chain. That's where they compromise computers before you even buy them, by inserting malware at some point in the chain from manufacture to sale. They also are using trusted insiders, people in your own organization that wittingly or unwittingly are helping them. And now we are seeing an increase in use of proximity attacks. These are attacks and intrusions using such things as Bluetooth and Wi-Fi and other wireless accesses that can be achieved without even physically touching, in the electronic sense, a computer. So what does the typical cyber criminal, the individual that is committing this sort of crime, look like these days? Well, most of the cyber criminals that we are encountering are not hardened convicts. Most are white-collar criminals who just think they can outsmart law enforcement. However, the ubiquitous nature of computer technology and the potential amount of money that can be made is resulting in cybercrime becoming more popular with your traditional, violent, organized crime organizations. Alarmingly so, we are now seeing an increased number of cybercriminals who have criminal histories and who are not afraid to use violence, and in fact who do engage in violence to further their cyber criminal activity. Cyber criminals have also evolved over the past decade. In the not too distant past, your typical cyber criminal was a lone operator. One person would conceive of the crime, devise a means to commit it, and then benefit from it, relying on his or her own skills and keeping the profits for themselves. Such self-reliant cyber criminals are increasingly rare in the cybercrime world of the 21st century. Cyber criminals now are typically members of at least one online forum, website, or chat service, and there are numerous online forums, websites, or chat services that are really geared for cyber criminals. Some of these are public. Anybody can find them, while others have requirement for membership, and you can only gain access if somebody else who knows you because of a cyber crime or exploit that you have conducted vouches for you. And we are seeing cyber criminals trading tips and techniques with each other. We are also seeing a trend of specialization and organization amongst the ranks of cyber criminals. Cyber criminals are now increasingly becoming more corporate in the way they operate, and really operating like your traditional organized crime organizations, such as the La Cosa Nostra. What we're seeing now in a lot of your major cybercrime cases is a core group of trusted associates who bring different skill sets to the table and who work together to plan and commit their crimes as efficiently as possible. And we're seeing these core groups of criminals, the bosses, if you will, reaching out to a variety of cybercrime subcontractors or other specialists who engage in very specific tasks without knowing the full picture of the criminal enterprise. So cybercriminals now are truly operating in ways analogous to traditional organized crime. You have bosses and the brains behind the scheme. You have individual criminals with particular specialties that are brought in to assist. The best analogy for this is if you think back to the 1930s and the 1940s, when you had the traditional and legendary bank burglary and bank robbery gangs of the gangster era. In those types of gangs, you had the bosses who planned the crime, you had the wheelmen who drove the getaway cars, and you had the lookouts at the crime scene, and then you had the guys who actually knew how to crack the safe or would storm the bank with guns. Well, just as we saw with the old-time bank burglary and bank robbery gangs, we are now seeing cyber gangs operate in the same manner. Today, we see a number of different specializations in the organized cybercrime world. First of all, you have the coders or the programmers. These are the people who write the malware, who write the exploits, and develop the other cyber tools necessary to commit the crime. Then you have those who trade and sell in stolen data and intellectual property. An example of this would be the individual who sells stolen credit card numbers that he obtained from a hacker. These individuals basically are analogous to the traditional fence that you've heard about. If you watch old TV crime series and all that, the fence is the guy that sells that stolen property that he obtains from the burglars and the like. We are also seeing people now who specialize in providing the technical support needed to maintain the cyber criminals' infrastructure. These are criminals who maintain servers, secure ISPs, encryption systems, and the like, and they maintain them strictly for the use of individuals wishing to commit a cybercrime. Some of these people also maintain things like proxy networks and provide botnets for sale to others who wish to use them to commit a cybercrime. You still see hackers and crackers out there. Those are the people who search for and exploit application system and network vulnerabilities to gain administrator access. And now we're seeing people who specialize in the human engineering fraud schemes, and they create and deploy social engineering schemes such as phishing, spamming, and domain squatting. And then finally, we see the financial criminals who control the drop accounts and run networks of money couriers, we refer to them as money mules, and also launder the illicit proceeds. This level of specialization has been very beneficial to cyber criminals because they can now focus on staying up to date in their chosen capacity, and it also insulates them from discovery by law enforcement and potentially from prosecution if we can't find them. So now your coders can focus on staying up to date on the advances in software and hardware, and they can focus on looking for the vulnerabilities and devoting the exploits. We are seeing some coders now that are actually developing customizable automated malware kits that they will sell to other cyber criminals. And these kits literally contain multiple exploits, different attacks, and they're linked together in an automated package such that each attack is tried sequentially until one succeeds. And these are offered for sale in some of these cyber criminal-related chat rooms and forums. We're seeing the fraudsters, the social engineering types, becoming more specialized in developing schemes to target specific individuals with administrator or financial system access. We're seeing these people now oftentimes conducting extensive research of publicly available information and of social networking sites and of corporate websites and corporate products such as financial reports and the like to develop information and a profile of individuals in a variety of corporations so that they can then develop a specific scheme designed to target a specific individual in a specific corporation and make it appear that a spear phishing email, in fact, is coming from a colleague known to the victim in their very own company. That's the type of sophistication and effort we're seeing, and because they're specializing, they are able to do that now. Even the money mules, the couriers of money, are starting to become specialized. While we still see some of the money mules as people who are innocently duped into becoming conduits of money through internet-sponsored work-from-your-home scams and the like, we are now also seeing career mules, career money couriers, who regularly engage in transferring money between bank accounts for a percentage of the cut. And we are also seeing now an increasing number of mules who are recruited overseas and specifically sent to the United States on student or work visas for the purpose of establishing a physical presence here, opening bank accounts, and then using those bank accounts to transfer money on behalf of international cyber criminals. So now that I've painted a somewhat grim picture for you, you're probably thinking, what are we doing about it? And more importantly, what should we be doing about it? Well, the good news is we have made combating this challenge a top priority, not only for the FBI, but the entire U.S. government. For the FBI, it is our third highest national priority, our number one priority being counterterrorism, number two, counterintelligence, and now number three is cybercrime. The FBI has formed cyber squads in each of its 56 field offices, and the one here in Omaha, the one that conducted the Trident breach investigation, is actually known as one of the precedent-setting and cutting-edge cyber task forces in the country. So you should be very proud of the fact that your community is well-served in that regard. The FBI now has more than 1,000 cyber-trained FBI special agents, intelligence analysts, and forensic examiners. And we've increased the capabilities of our employees by selectively seeking candidates with the specialized skills that they need. In the last 4 or 5 years, we have made a concerted effort and successfully hired many agents with advanced degrees in computer science or information technology. Many of the individuals we are hiring have prior work experience as systems administrators or network security specialists. And if there are any information technology majors in the audience today, I would encourage you to consider a career with the FBI. We've learned and we have shown that hiring people with these skills and then teaching them to be FBI agents and investigators is much more effective than trying to teach an old-time FBI agent like me how to conduct a cyber investigation. As an agency with both national security and law enforcement responsibility, the FBI is well-positioned to address the cyber threat. The anonymity of the Internet often creates challenges in determining exactly who the adversary is, but because we have both intelligence and law enforcement authorities and we have an international reach, we are often able to successfully investigate, identify, and target the criminal as well as the foreign intelligence and international terrorist actors. But the thing is, we in the FBI recognize that we cannot do it alone. No one agency is capable of protecting the Internet and is capable of addressing the cybercrime threat. As a result, the FBI initiated the National Cyber Investigative Joint Task Force, NCIJTF. It is now recognized throughout the United States government as the premier entity for coordinating cybercrime types of investigations, and more than 20 federal agencies are full-time members now of the NCI-JTF. This task force operates under the concept of threat-focused cells. What that means is within this entity, we have small groups of agents, officers, and analysts from the 20 different agencies, all of which are subject matter experts. And each of these small groups focuses on a very, very specific threat and devises schemes to address that threat from top to bottom, and then harnesses the abilities of each of the 20 member agencies to actually initiate investigations and operations to try to defeat our adversaries when it comes to the cyber threat. Through the NCI-JTF, we have collected real-time intelligence that has actually allowed us to thwart cyber crimes before they have occurred. We've also forged tremendous relationships with the private sector and with academia through such programs as the FBI InfraGuard program, which is an FBI-sponsored public-private partnership network with more than 36,000 members. These partnerships have led to robust information sharing through which we've prevented attacks before they've occurred and through which we've helped to sensitize the community as well as leverage the expertise that exists in academia and the private sector for the benefit of protecting this country's cyber infrastructure. There have been countless times as a result of these efforts where the FBI has gone to a company and told them they were breached and told them exactly where the intruder was to the network, and invariably the victim is shocked to learn of this. During the Trident breach investigation, I can count just in my own personal experience dozens of times when agents would contact the chief financial officer of one of the victim companies and say, did you just transfer $500,000 out of such and such an account? And of course, the person would say, no, I didn't. And then we would say, well, somebody did, and you've just been victimized, and we need to talk. And because there is that foreign nexus to cybercrime, we in the FBI, as well as other government agencies, are working closely with our international law enforcement partners. In fact, we now have FBI agents embedded in foreign police agencies around the world, specifically to jointly investigate cyber intrusions. And each year, we train approximately 500 foreign law enforcement officers by bringing them to the FBI Academy at Quantico. And these officers typically represent more than 40 different nations in every given class. These combined efforts of the FBI and our law enforcement and intelligence community partners have resulted in some success. In 2010, the FBI arrested 202 criminals specifically for cyber intrusions, and that was up from 159 in 2009. In addition, our foreign law enforcement partners have made dozens and dozens of arrests based on the information we've shared with them, and we've obtained a record of leveling financial judgments on those cases in excess of $100 million. The Trident breach case I mentioned that was run out of Omaha is an example of such a success. We worked with industry partners, law enforcement partners, and international partners in the Ukraine, the United Kingdom, the Netherlands, and Russia to apprehend the individuals involved with that scheme. All told, we carried out arrests, interviews, searches, and evidence seizures in nearly 20 cities in 12 different countries. But is all this enough? Well, I'm here to tell you today it is definitely not enough. To truly achieve the security we need in the cyber world, it is critical that we recognize the risk and that we collectively, as a community, develop the strategies needed to manage that risk. When you talk about risk, it's important to understand the risk model, which basically states that risk equals threat times vulnerability times consequence. I'll say that again. Risk equals threat times vulnerability times consequence. If you lower any one of those three variables of threat, vulnerability, or consequence, then you can lower the risk. And if you can completely eliminate any one of those variables, then you eliminate the risk because it is a multiplication formula. But it's impossible, of course, to completely eliminate any one of those variables. So the strategy that we have to adopt as a community, as a nation, is a defense-in-depth approach where we incrementally and in combination seek to lower each of those three factors as much as possible. And it's very easy to think of the risk model in the cyber world and translate it into the physical world. If you think of this model in terms of protecting your home from being robbed, there are easy analogies that can be drawn. If you think about protecting your home from being robbed, The threat, of course, is the burglars. If there are no burglars in your area, then you have no threat. If you know for a fact that there are no burglars in your community, you wouldn't need to lock your doors. You wouldn't need to spend money on a security system because there's no possibility that you would get robbed if there are no burglars in your community. And it doesn't matter how many valuables you have. However, if all of a sudden you get reports that there are burglars operating in your area, well, now you have a threat and you know that people's homes are being broken into, then you begin worrying about your vulnerabilities. And the vulnerabilities are the ways at which the burglar can get to you and your valuables. So what do you do in that physical world? If the threat is burglars and you're worried about it, you start trying to decrease your vulnerabilities. You start locking your doors. You leave the outside lights on. Maybe you put in an alarm system. You might even take some of your most precious valuables and take them out of the house and put them in a safe deposit box or purchase a safe for your home. Or you could potentially create a community watch, which in the past couple of weeks has been a pretty controversial topic. But you might create a community watch to look out for the bad guys and protect not only your own property, but your whole neighborhood. Or maybe, if you have the means to do so, you choose to move to a gated community where there is a fence around the whole neighborhood and a security guard checks IDs at the gates and only lets authorized individuals into your community. What about consequences? Well, that's what happens if the burglar succeeds, if they actually steal your valuables. So consequences are what you must address if the bad guy gets in. How do you manage those consequences? You can do things like purchase homeowners insurance to replace the valuables that you might lose. Or you might put up a hidden video surveillance system in your home. Now, while that won't protect your valuables from being stolen, it might help you recover them afterwards and catch the criminals that did it. These concepts can easily be translated into the cybersecurity realm. We've already established that the threat exists, and they're out there. Those are your criminals, your foreign intelligence agencies, and your terrorist groups. We know there are many adversaries that wish to exploit the cyber world to our detriment for their own gain. So we are attempting to reduce that threat by taking law enforcement, intelligence, and economic action to deter each of those adversaries from acting. However, the fact of the matter is, no matter how effective we are, I believe that the cyber threat will continue for the foreseeable future because the very nature of cybercrime provides anonymity to the criminal that attenuates any deterrent effect you might have. So now we move to vulnerabilities. How do we lower the vulnerabilities of a cyber attack? Well, that requires hardening the targets, just like you lower the vulnerabilities to your home being burglarized. So we have to protect the supply chain. We have to provide better security from manufacturer to point of sale for cyber technology items. It could also involve locking up certain pieces of information by either keeping it off the network or encrypting it or placing it in a place on the network that only certain people can get to. It also means scrubbing your own websites, your social networking sites, your web pages, your social networking pages to eliminate the types of information that fraudsters can exploit to develop the phishing schemes that are targeting specific individuals. One of our greatest challenges in terms of dealing with the vulnerabilities in the cyber world is that as the use of technology increases, the vulnerabilities become greater. You know, almost everybody, I would be willing to bet, in this room is carrying a computer in your pocket, your purse, or on your belt. There are now computers on airplanes. There are computers in your cars. And there are now products on the open market that allow people to do things like control the heat in their homes, program their televisions, and activate or deactivate their alarm systems remotely over the Internet. Each of those increases our vulnerabilities, and those are the things that we have to literally try to lock down, to use the analogy of the physical world. Lowering those vulnerabilities may require us to consider alternate models for a more secure Internet. And that is a somewhat controversial topic, but that's a topic that must be discussed and must be addressed. You know, going back to our crime in the neighborhood analogy, I mentioned that some people choose to live in gated communities that have heightened security by focusing on who can enter and who cannot enter and having guards around the community. Well, the community's guards will look for the bad guys and report them to police and hopefully also keep them out. A similar type of alternate security model may translate meaningfully to the Internet as well, and that's one of those discussions that we need to have. The reason the Internet is the way it is currently is that it was designed that way by the individuals who developed it. It was purposely designed to allow for anonymity, and there are many legitimate reasons for wanting to keep it that way. And I'm certainly not advocating eliminating the anonymity of the Internet, because it provides many, many benefits, and for many uses of the Internet, it is entirely appropriate. However, there is some instances, I would submit, there are some instances where we need to consider an alternate model for how the Internet should work. But for some critical uses of the Internet where an intrusion would be entirely unacceptable and the risk of compromise be entirely too dangerous for us to consider, we need to apply market-driven factors, and we as customers and we as the businesses and the developers of those types of services on the Internet must seek a mutually acceptable solution that provides the security we need while also provides the service that we need. And then managing the consequences of a cyber attack entails minimizing the harm that results. Just like you buy homeowners insurance to help you recover from having your valuables stolen, we need to develop schemes to help manage the consequences of a successful cyber attack, because we are guaranteed pretty much that there will continue to be successful attacks. So how might we manage the consequences? We might consider encrypting the data so that the hacker can't read it, or we might consider having redundant systems, so if something is attacked, it really doesn't matter because another system will take over. We might want to consider implementing data assurance mechanisms that allows us to instantaneously detect when somebody has made a change to our data or to our network or to our hardware. And we might consider enhancing the ability to have attribution on the Internet, that is, to determine who is doing what on the Internet, at least to certain portions of the Internet. To do any of these things, we have to develop a very strong partnership between academia, the business sector, and law enforcement. Businesses, academic institutions, and government entities, indeed all entities in cyberspace, must be willing to work together. We must be willing to share information. We must be willing to report intrusions and then work collaboratively with law enforcement agencies to go after the threat actors. Currently, there is a hesitancy among many portions of society to go after cyber threat actors. They prefer to keep the fact that they've been intruded upon quiet. Well, I will tell you, if we do not go after the threat actors, that will only serve to embolden them and to increase the risks that we all face. It is essential that we begin a public dialogue about these issues. It's not enough just for the experts and the cyber geeks and the cyber agents and sleuths to be talking about it. It is something that we as a society must become engaged upon. We must take the time to assess and evaluate the risk postures of our organizations and agencies, and we must ask whether we have the proper balance of security and access to ensure the long-term viability of the Internet. Because it is my belief and the belief of my colleagues in the FBI that the current model, whereby we are constantly playing defense after the fact, is in the long run an unsustainable model. We have to determine whether existing cyber risks are too great for the benefits received, and we must find ways to improve our data and our cyber infrastructure systems. Those discussions, I submit, must begin now, and I challenge each of you to play a part in initiating those sorts of discussions. The solutions to this dilemma have to be developed through a collaborative and a cooperative effort by the customers, the technologists, the entrepreneurs, and by law enforcement. We have to continue to push forward together because our adversaries in the cyber world are relentless. They want our money, they want our property, they want our secrets, and some seek to harm us physically as well. As Director Mueller of the FBI noted last month in his remarks before the RSA conference, he said, "We're losing data, we're losing money, we're losing ideas, and we're losing the innovation of our nation." So as I close, I will challenge you to not ignore the threat. I challenge you to work together with us in law enforcement and with other sectors of the society, and together we must seek a way to stop the bleeding. Together, it is my belief we can turn the tide against our adversaries, and together we can bolster the security of our nation's information and networks and infrastructure. I guess that's it. Well,
thank you very much. Let's give another round of applause to Mr. Dunn.
You've been listening to a lecture from Creighton University on Noon Forum. We've heard a talk by Wei-San Dunn, Special Agent in Charge of the Omaha Division of the Federal Bureau of Investigation. Mr. Dunn's appearance was presented by the Creighton University Asian World Center as part of their Distinguished Lecture Series, in collaboration with the Creighton Students' Union. He spoke on the topic, Navigating the Cyber Threat Landscape of the 21st Century. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Thursday afternoon, March 29, 2012, for broadcast at this time. Special thanks to Cindy Workman, Associate Director of Public Relations at Creighton University, and to Marong Jang, the Director of the Creighton Asian World Center, for helping to make the recording and broadcast of this program possible. Complete Noon Forum listings, as well as an archive of previous broadcasts, are available on our website, kios.org. Now, this is your producer and host, Bob Cote, thanking you for listening.